Hello and welcome to another edition of Confessing Our Hope, the podcast of Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. My name is Zach Groff. I'm the host of the podcast, and I have with me in the studio today Dr. Joseph A. Pipa, Jr., our president and professor of systematic and homiletical theology. Dr. Pipa, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Zach. It's always good to be in here with you.
Today, we're doing something a little bit different. In the past, we typically do our monthly faith and practice installment where I ask Dr. Pipa questions. We're going to get back to that pretty soon. But in light of his imminent transition into solely a faculty position and setting aside the presidential responsibilities, I figured we would take a little bit of a breather from the Q&A, and I would ask Dr. Pipa to share with us his personal testimony and to hit on some of the high notes, what Ian Hamilton would probably call the principal notes of his pastoral ministry as we prepare to welcome Jonathan Master into our midst next year. And in fact, I do intend to do this with each of our faculty members in coming months. If you look back in the history of Confessing Our Hope, you'll see that, or you'll notice, rather, that I did a similar interview with Dr. Jim McGoldrick a couple years ago in honor of the 500th anniversary of the Reformation.
Of Reformation or Dr. McGoldrick?
of the Reformation, but we tied it into his personal testimony coming out of Romanism and into Protestantism. So anyway, without further ado, I want to begin diving into Dr. Pipa's personal testimony. I've had the privilege of hearing it in various settings and iterations and personal conversations on multiple occasions, and I'm excited for him to share with our audience today. Dr. Pipa, why don't you get us started and share a little bit about your background and upbringing, and then where you were first confronted with the gospel and your conversion narrative.
Thank you, Zach. Always glad to talk about that. I was raised in a kind of Roman, superstitious Roman Catholic environment. My father was Roman Catholic. My mother wasn't, but had agreed for any children to be raised within the church. I went 3 years to parochial school, very zealous for it until I began to get into adolescence and began to have questions and problems. And in about 1956, my father committed adultery. My mother left him, very earth-shaking. Divorce was not common amongst the plebeians in those days. And part of the procedure was, and I don't know why, outside of God's providence, I don't know the human cause, but my mother had to move to Pensacola, Florida, where he was next going to be stationed. He was in the Navy, to get a divorce. And so here's my life, a complete mess. And then we moved to Pensacola. They divorced in 1957. And I was just in rebellion and turmoil. I began to get in trouble. I was on probation with the juvenile authorities. And actually, probably the days, weeks before I was converted, committed a really heinous sin. And I'd been under conviction of sin, and God converted me at the Pensacola Youth Crusade, which went on every July. And the conservative churches and the PCUS in those days all sent the young people there. I still have friends from those youth crusades. So yeah, I was converted, and I don't know the people's name. I look forward to seeing them in heaven, but they came to me. They were neighbors, and they said, "We know what you did, but we also know that you've just been converted," which I don't know how they knew that, and so we're not going to do anything about it. If they had done something about it, I would have been probably sent off to whatever they called it in those days, reform school. Anyway, so God converted me right as I was starting high school, ninth grade. I see how God used that, all of that mess in my life, to bring me to Pensacola, to bring me to himself, to get me initially grounded in evangelicalism and introduced to the Reformed faith, not in a consistent manner in those days, but in a foundational manner, I would say. By my junior year in high school, I had a very subtle conviction that I was called to the ministry, and so I set my course in that direction. And so I attended Belhaven College, which, again, in those days, was kind of the citadel for any conservative Southern Presbyterians. And then was one of the earliest classes at Reformed Theological Seminary, where I had the privilege of not only studying under Dr. Smith, but being mentored by him. I went to seminary with two questions, covenant baptism and the extent of the atonement. And by God's grace, those two questions were answered the first year. So I met my wife through my roommate. She is a native Mississippian. She was raised in the Southern Baptist Church, but God just opened her heart to love the Reformed faith and worship and the Sabbath. And we got married in 1971, the same summer I was ordained. At that point, I was pastoring in Chula, Mississippi, which is in the Delta, about 70 miles northwest of Jackson, Mississippi. I had been doing some pulpit supply there my second year in seminary. They asked me to come in the summer as a student, which I did. God worked. There were some people were converted. So they asked me to come as a student supply then for a year.
Great. That's very helpful for getting a foundation for where you were coming from and bringing us all the way up to your seminary days and your first pastorate. You neglected to mention a crucial detail from your first year of seminary. It was not only where you had those theological questions settled, but you also began sporting a mustache, isn't it?
A second year, I think.
It was your second year?
Yeah, I think it was my second year.
So the stash has been around since the second year
the
of seminary.
The stash is older than my children, older than my marriage. And my stash actually has its own Twitter account.
It does.
Says some really outrageous things. But I enjoy it when he does those things. He has a mind of his own. Obviously, I would never say such things.
Dr. Pipe is not involved in the Stash's account. Neither am I. And to the best of our knowledge, we are not completely sure of who runs it, though we have our suspicions.
Well, I have heard that they pass it around, so nobody can really be tagged. But
I mean, it's a team effort. Well, Dr. Pipe, going back to your early days at those Youth Crusades and Pensacola Theological Institute, who were some of the standout speakers that really impressed you as a youth, but even leading up to before you got to Belhaven?
Oh, I don't know if I can remember that, because some of them were after I was away at college and coming home in the summers for it.
Well, you can mention them as well.
Al Martin was probably the most significant. Joel Niederhood, J.I. Packer, probably more influential, maybe two things. One's the friendships that continued to develop. If you've read the history of the PCA, you recognize the Pensacola Institute, which I didn't really mention in my testimony, was very influential. A ruling elder, O.H. Smith, the father of Bill Smith, was kind of the guiding force behind this. It was always more consistently Reformed than the church ministry was. But this was the magnet that people came to. And it was a great kind of vacation because you had Lord's Day services and then morning activities, afternoons on the beach. Most of the people got beach cottages and then evening services.
And they would do a week-long deal, right?
Sunday through Sunday, Lord's Day through Lord's Day.
So they've recently renewed the Pensacola Theological Institute in partnership with the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. And the pastors there, Rob and Lewis, have formatted it over a weekend at this point. I mean, week-long conferences don't usually get as much traction nowadays as they used to, but they're doing it every other year. And I try to get down there to represent Greenville Seminary for a number of reasons, because of the importance in Dr. Pipa's personal testimony, but also because it's hosted at McIlwain Presbyterian Church, where Dr. Pipa was discipled in those early years.
Rob had me down there to preach a weekend conference, and part of that was the plan. Let's see how this goes, because we're thinking about trying to renew the Institute. So the friendships. The other thing, though, is I have books in my library that I started buying in high school. I think that's when I got Packer's Evangelism and the Sovereignty of God, for example. So, yeah, those were important years. I wasn't really mentored personally by individuals. I kind of developed my life out of books, and that's just how God led me. But after this summer in Chula, I didn't want to go to Chula. I mean, this was culturally about as opposite of a place as a person could be. I was a beach person. I had longer hair, and I had very distinctly different racial views than the culture in Holmes County. But it was a strange marriage. It's glorious. They called me then, even after there was the first group had left the church because of my views. The church still called me. Some others leave the church, but in God's providence, two of the men that left the church were converted and came back and became my best friends. I trained them as elders just a few years ago. One died, other one I usually see at least once a year. And so the first 3 years in Chula were miserable because of the tensions, the splits, and then the Spirit just began to operate. That's why I encourage men, you don't bail out, you know. So the last three and a half years were quite a wonderful time.
What was the crux of the conflict? What you said because of racial views, and then of course there's some cultural disparity just between yourself as a Pensacola Beach bum,
yeah,
versus
I walked up
cotton
town.
Farmers in
I walked uptown one time in cutoffs and barefoot, scandalized the entire town.
Because you're the Presbyterian preacher walking around.
They walk around in blue jeans and cowboy boots. I thought that was pretty casual. So, actually, in those days then, after that scandal, I wore a coat and tie, even though my study was in the house. I wore a coat and tie every day I was in the study because I wanted people to know that I was at work just as the banker or the lawyer or the school teacher was at work. And I would get up at 6 o'clock in the morning. I mean, a lot of the men didn't want my being there, and go eat breakfast with the farmers when I was still single, so that they would know that I was up working when they were up working. So I developed a number of habits in those days that I've kept ever since. So
yeah, you bridged the cultural divide on that score and accommodated yourself. What about the conflicts in other areas?
So in the other areas was the one thing was I didn't make divisions in public. So if I met an African-American in the post office, particularly if it was an older gentleman, I'd shake his hand and I would address him as sir. In the hearts of some people, that was scandalous. Not a lot now, and not people in my church. So you had the culture, the broader culture, then you had the people in the church. Now, some had left, but that was because I was emphasizing the need to start evangelizing the blacks in the community on the farms, and with the goal of trying to start a African-American Presbyterian church. Because at that point, there was no way that the African-American community could have come to our church and understood the sermons. There was such a huge difference.
In educational level.
Not just but in biblical education. Not just in education, but in any grasp of Scripture.
Would that have had something to do with literacy in general or biblical literacy
in particular? And that was, we were trying to teach one of the young tractor drivers to read who had a high school diploma. But what did happen in that process is that some women came to our elders. They didn't come to me. They went to the elders and asked if I could start doing services for them.
Some women from the local black congregation.
Yes, yeah. Because in those days, none of the African-American congregations had full-time pastors in these smaller towns. And so the pastor would come once or twice a month. So some of them had cooked at a camp I ran for the Presbytery. Others had been at funerals I'd done. And they saw the difference. And so they came and asked if I could start holding services for them on the two Sundays they didn't have a pastor.
When you say they saw the difference, you mean they picked up on the fact that your sermons were thoroughly scriptural in content and
very
applicatory.
Different from the emotional stuff they were getting on the Lord's Day.
Okay.
Yeah. And they wanted something better. So the elders agreed, and I started doing that. Basically, I would take the sermons that I would preach into my congregation and simply try to make them not in a condescending way, but just to meet those people where they were. I actually read a couple of books on black preaching as well. And the Lord blessed greatly. Now, that we were meeting in the Black Baptist Church until that preacher got jealous and we got kicked out of that. So but this is an interesting part of the story. The first Lord's Day I was there, when I left, they gave me a brown paper bag. So I got to the house, and it was full of cash. So I called one of my closest friends, a really an elder who really understood the African-American community. I said, "John Edgar, what's going on here?" He says, "Oh, son," he said, "on the day of preaching, the offering goes to the preacher, all of it. And the days I don't have preaching, that's to go to run the church and stuff like that." So I went back 2 weeks later. We were doing this every 2 weeks. And I said, "You know, I appreciate it. Labor is worthy of hire. But my church is paying me to do this, and I'd rather you didn't do this every time. In fact, I think you should save the money because you might have to rent a place for us to." Because the goal was actually to move toward a church. Well, sure enough, we got kicked out of that Black Baptist church, and these ladies took the money then that they'd been collecting an offering and started renting a daycare center where we met then for the rest of the time that I was there. And it was a grand time. After the sermon, then we would sit and have coffee and cookies and talk about the sermon to be sure they understood what I was saying. And it was actually African-American politics that broke that work up, as the two sides of the community got opposed on stuff in the city council and all that, and destroyed it after I'd left.
When you say African-American politics broke up that gathering that was moving toward a church, there were ladies within the congregation that were on opposing sides of the political issues in the town.
Yeah, one of them, a dear friend. In fact, a few years ago, I was doing a Bible conference at the old church, and she came, sat down beside me, and I was doing it with one of our graduates, Josh Martin, and she whispered, said, "Is Dr. Piper here?" And I said, "Miss Banks, do you not recognize me?" So she came, and then she came back afterwards with the group for the fellowship time in between. This is just how God was blessing.
So you had lasting friendships with these folks to whom you were ministering, even on the periphery of your main call there in Chula.
Yeah, yeah. So, and since then, for example, one lady that left the church because I said we needed to evangelize the blacks later.
One lady who left Chula,
right,
the
church,
PCA church,
came
here,
to me,
or PCUS church,
and said, asked me if I knew a certain African-American PCA pastor. I said I did. And her next words out of her mouth, and she'd gone to the White Flight Church, next words out of her mouth was, "He preached our pastor's ordination." And the next words were, "And if I lived in Jackson, I'd go to his church." You see, that's what the gospel does. And that's what people today, I think, need to understand and get their priorities right. Well, anyway, the last year and a half in Chula, I began to get pressure from some friends to go do doctoral studies. I didn't want to do doctoral studies. I just wanted to pastor in Chula, Mississippi the rest of my life. But we prayed about it, got pressed. I got a job with Great Commission Publications and accepted at Westminster Seminary. So we were there for about 3 years.
In Philadelphia.
And I started teaching adjunct at that time, pastoral theology course, and actually worked with some pretty prominent OPC guys now on preaching, Tony Curto, amongst others. And so then I wanted to stay in Philadelphia. I had a job that was flexible enough, and I'd be able to write my dissertation, but the Lord moved us to Houston, Texas. So after 3 years in Philly, where I not only did my doctoral studies but began to teach some at a seminary level, we went to Houston, pastored there for 10 and a half years. Church went from about 75 to 150 and transferred out another 200 or so in the oil patch. There's a lot of turnover there, but it's built by God's grace, a very good ministry, out of which three other churches were planted, one in Houston, one in Nacogdoches, and one in Beaumont, all which are thriving today as well. Toward the end of the 10 and a half years, the Lord was beginning to move. I went up, gave a lecture at Westminster Philly. Then I was actually invited to interview at Covenant Seminary. And at the end of that time, Bob Godfrey, who was teaching church history, wasn't president of Westminster, California at that point, asked me if I would consider coming and taking Jay Adams' place and running the program and preaching.
And interestingly, a little side note, you didn't get into all the different places where your dad was stationed in your childhood, but Escondido was actually one of the places that you had lived for a short time as a boy while your dad was stationed out there with the Navy. And then you were making
And my daughter,
return.
for my 45th or 50th, found the house and got pictures of it, and then we went to see it as well. So, yeah, that was an interesting time in my life. Family life was always miserable. I had a fifth grade teacher, though, in Escondido that just was a male model. He also took me to...
When you say male model, you mean a role model?
Yeah.
To you? Yeah.
Took me and some other of the students up to Pasadena to one of the great USC football games.
And when you say Bob USC,
Hope,
you
University
mean...
Not the real USC, the University of Southern California.
The real USC, University of South Carolina.
That's right.
Just down
so
the
anyway, so we went out there then in the summer of 1990.
Well, before we get there, tell us a little bit more about the ministry in Houston. That's where you forged a relationship with John Perkins, is it not?
Yes. I had read some of Perkins' works and went to the elders, and I thought it could be very important. For those that wouldn't know, Perkins had a fantastic ministry in Mississippi in Mendenhall. Soteriologically, pretty sound guy, and really had thought through a lot of the social conflict issues. So he came and did a series for us on those things, very well attended. And I would say at that point, although I've not seen him in years, that we became friends. So yeah, that was good. Of course, and we had being in Houston, you get a lot more cultural diversity than you would have in Mississippi. And so we had a diverse membership in the church there as well. We got to build a building that won all kinds of architectural awards, built around Reformed principles of worship. And so that was, in many ways, Houston was a hard city to live in because of time consumption and going places. It would take us the last couple of years maybe an hour to get our children, 45 minutes an hour to get them to their school. We were always in a Christian school, and then could in the afternoon do it in 20 minutes.
And pastoral visitation was difficult, especially before the plants were established.
Right. And so I visited everybody annually and trained the elders to do that as well. God bless that. We had a lot of young professionals converted or really come back to walk with Christ. We had one young guy that he was a very good tennis player. He'd meet all these people at tennis clubs, and he'd bring me all of his, like a dog, bringing home beraggle things. And so a lot of conversions, a lot of marriages then of young couples come to the Reformed faith. So it was a very busy time in our life. Our kids, when we went there, Sarah was 6 and Joey was 4. So we were there for 10 and a half years. They more or less grew up there. But a lot of close friends there as well. And now one of our graduates, Lou Vega, is pastoring that church.
And he's the clerk of the presbytery.
And he's clerk of the presbytery. Yeah. Interestingly, by doing this in Houston, we developed what I think is a very good strategy for church planting. In fact, the last of the churches that we planted was a denominational seeker-sensitive church plant in Beaumont. The guy that was there gave up, left, recommended closing the thing down. And a group of people came to our session and said, "We know you've started churches. Would you take this over?" So we said, "If you go back to being a mission group, and here's the things that we will require." Yes. Now a Greenville grad's there. Other two men, the intern and me, are in the other two churches. And
That is glorious.
It's really great.
You know, we're about to make a shift here to Escondido and talk about your seminary career in Westminster West, and then ultimately here at Greenville. But before we do, if you had to pick out 3 to 5 principal notes of your pastoral ministry, briefly, just state them, what would it have been, drawing out of Chula?
Consecutive expository preaching, which I started day one, had not been taught it by God's grace. I had 3 adopted models, Al Martin, John R. Stott, and Martin Lloyd-Jones. Faithful pastoral visitation in the home, and then discipleship mentoring.
Yeah, very good. And a great resource in discipleship is Dr. Pipa's commentary or study guide through the Westminster Confession of Faith. We carry that here at Greenville Seminary.
Which came out of my whole burden about discipleship.
All right, great. Well, moving on to, in our remaining time, talk a little bit about your experiences at Westminster West and
also
Greenville.
When we got to California, I was supposed to do was run the DMIN program, but then they asked if I would also teach on the MDiv level. So I said, I'll teach anything. I don't remember how many in those 7.5 years, how many new courses I prepared. Somebody go on sabbatical, I would teach. I taught systematics for Strimple, church history for Godfrey. I taught preaching. I taught evangelism. And everyone was new preparation. But that was good for me. And early on there, I had some people come to me who knew my views on worship somehow and asked if I would start a PCA church. The one that was there was a bit more innovative. And so went to that pastor and the presbytery, and everybody was behind that. So I took a third job, and that was starting a church.
When you say some people approached you, were those seminary students or people in the community or what?
People mostly connected with the seminary at that point. Now, we eventually were able to see a number of people from the community come as well. So that gave me another 7 years of pastoral. I have 22 years of pastoral experience by doing that when we were there. Eventually, at one point, I think I had 17 interns that I was meeting with regularly and mentoring them as well. But that was good, although I went through some real spiritual tests in those days that I can say that I stumbled but didn't fall. Looking back, that was good as well. So the church was a good experience. Eventually, one of the interns, who was a ruling elder, then became the associate pastor. Another two of the ruling elders are pastors now, one in the PCA in Florida, one in the OPC in North Carolina. Again, all close friends. In fact, it's interesting, a year after we left, that church folded. We had continual church discipline problems. That's probably the nature of trying to have a spiritual church in California. And there was one couple in particular, the lady wanted to divorce her husband. We kept telling her that she had no biblical grounds to divorce her husband. And then we had another case. We'd excommunicated a girl in her late teens because of horrendous sexual activity, which she admitted to. We didn't have to have a trial. She said, yes, I've done all these things, and I'm not going to repent. Excommunicated her. At that point, her family was 100% behind it, but after I left, they changed and decided that we weren't fair. It was way past the statute of limitations, but they went to the presbytery, and the presbytery leaned on the church to restore her. So you got that happening. This other woman by that felt emboldened to go ahead with her divorce, and that simply finished shattering the church.
That's so sad.
Which was hard. But on the other hand, the one thing I see that God did out of that, there are a lot of men now, conservative reformed pastors that came through that ministry in that church, and that was evidently God's purpose for it. So I ran the DMIN program in preaching, which also was good for me. That's where I was able to really develop the curriculum for homiletics that we use here now and the curriculum for worship that we use here now. And so it was good. It was one thing to be a preacher. It's something else to begin to become reflective about preaching. And some men can't do one or the other. I think I can do both a little bit. And so it was good in that way. The other thing that was good for me there was having to do academic administration. Because when the call came from here to be the first president of Greenville Seminary, that was a very big need. And I would have known nothing about academic administration if I'd not been running an academic program. And so I can see how God, you know, in all the various preparations, because when I first came here, I also was teaching lots of different things.
Tell us about that earth-moving call. Who called you? Was it a member of the board?
Dr. Knight, who was actually the big architect behind this. I guess I was really the only candidate that was seriously considered, although there was some objections to me, just people's apprehension and whatever, but it was unanimous from the board. He reached out to me about my interest, and his involvement was very much an encouragement to me, because I knew he understood that side of things, the academic administration. And of course, Dr. Smith's involvement, a spiritual father, and the opportunity to work with him for the last almost 18 years then of his public ministry as well. So, we prayed about it because I was pastoring a church, took it to the elders and asked them if they thought I should go. And they unanimously thought that I should go as well. So we left there December of 97, started here January 1st, 98. And we've been here now for 22 years, this December 30th, 31st.
It's a remarkable tenure.
We're thankful. A lot more than I expected.
Mm-hmm. How did you build on the work that had already been done here by the board and by the men who were teaching here at Greenville Seminary? What strengths did you encounter when you got here that you built on? And then what things did you maybe make improvements on or shift gears a little bit for?
Well, confessionally, the strengths were very good, and Dr. Smith's courses laid the foundation for that. At that time, Dr. Singer was still teaching some church history, and then Dr. Johnson, who now teaches at Erskine, I think, was an adjunct in church history. So those two, and then Dr. Shaw and Dr. Dyer were here, again, very committed to the concept of Greenville that we want men to graduate really able to read Greek and Hebrew. And that was the core of the faculty. And then there was a person here that was teaching homiletics, who actually I got to do a D-min in homiletics under me as I was wrapping up the program in California. What we didn't have, though, was a campus life at that point. We were in a cramped facility. So one of my first, actually before I moved here in January, I was flying over once a month to look for properties. And we found the Independent Baptist Church property that we moved into then that August of 98, just as school was starting. You know, developed an academic structure, handbooks and stuff like that, and policies. And then one of my goals then was to work with the board to bring in really confessional, experimental Calvinists. And God gave us, I mean, we had the core of men and Dr. Patterson and Mr. Van Voorhis, some of those ruling elders from here in Greenville. Lig Duncan was initially, was on the board until he died. He was one of the men that started the seminary. In fact, when I came over to interview, Mrs. Duncan, whom I greatly cherish, said, "Joey, this was a day that Lig would have loved. He always wanted you here." That was quite encouraging.
Did he know you before?
Yeah, we've met through the assembly, and I'd come over and spoken for one or two things that they'd had. And then, of course, Dr. Knight. So there obviously was a core there of men that shared the vision. And we've been able now to see God develop a board that is remarkable in terms of the ownership, the wisdom, the leadership that they give to the seminary, and that they have particularly given excellent leadership in this whole transition process as well. So I'm very thankful. I think that that's, again, one of the things. And, of course, this building that God has given to us, which we really need to get something much more permanent than we were in, and Lord willing, this January, then we will have paid off the mortgage on it as well.
So in your time here at Greenville Seminary since 98 to today, or I guess if you just go back to the beginning of the seminary to today, we've graduated, or the school's graduated, something on the order of 250 or 260.
I would think close to 300.
Yeah, maybe closer to 300 graduates, 240 or 50 of which are in some form of ordained ministry in the local church, either as ruling elders or teaching elders. I think not mostly, but about 45% in the PCA, then 25% in the OPC and other denominations at lower percentages beyond that. But just reflecting on how the Lord has so abundantly blessed the seminary under your leadership, I think that we can really give praise to God for bringing you here and for the time that you've spent here, and see clearly how your experiences, all maybe not at the moment while you were in the midst of it all, could you have guessed where the Lord was taking you, but they
right.
all feed into
yes, they do.
The program that we have here, with emphases on pastoral care, preaching the word in spiritual power, and then also being active in the courts of the church. That's one element of your public ministry we didn't really touch on a whole lot, is your involvement in the formation of the PCA, bringing Chula into the PCA, and then also your involvement in the courts of the church since then. But you're currently moderator of Calvary Presbytery of the PCA this year. Your term's about to wrap up at the end of the year. And I think most people who watch General Assembly know who you are and know what it looks like to see Joey Piper going to the microphone with a Bible in hand. So I think that that's another testament to...
You know, Zach, one of the things that I really thank the Lord for, amongst many, is the statistics today are that most seminary graduates, 50% are out of the ministry in 3 to 5 years. I can say that it's probably 90% of our graduates are still in the ministry from the 20 years. A few have gone to glory, but we've only a handful, you know, that either were preparing and didn't get a call, that's very rare, or they've been ordained, are not still in the ministry. And that's just, I think part of that gets into our whole front-end policy of trying to get a man in his session to determine if he's really called to the ministry before he comes, because guys go with unrealistic expectations, and it doesn't take but about half a year in a pastorate to get all those dashed. So I'm thankful that our men are finishing well.
That's right. Well, Dr. Piper, I think you got to get to class.
I
but
do.
This has
I
been
can
a
talk
very,
another hour with you, though.
Well, I wholeheartedly agree. And my goal is, or my aim for the podcast, is in a series of podcast episodes to bring in each of our faculty members and to ask them about their personal testimonies, their ministries, what has been a particular emphasis for them in the pulpit and in the classroom. As we close the podcast, I do want to remind our listeners that this particular program only exists because of the generous support of listeners like you, those who appreciate what Greenville Seminary is about, what we're doing in Reformed denominations around the world to equip men to be preachers, pastors, and churchmen for an enduring reformation in Christ's kingdom and in Christ's church. Though we are not the church, we do seek to serve the church, and I hope that was made abundantly clear in this episode where we discuss Dr. Piper's life and ministry and the principal notes of his ministry and how those things are reflected now in the life of Greenville Seminary. So if you would, please visit gpts.edu for news and updates about the seminary, and also visit gpts.edu/donate to make a gift to Greenville Seminary as part of our year-end campaign, where we anticipate bringing in 25% of our overall revenues for the entire year. Thank you again for listening, and have a blessed day.